Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We have got some war for you guys, we've got some peace, we've got a little bit of everything, or at least those two things, here in chapter 10, book 10, sorry, chapter 15, I just got so confused. Book 10, chapter 15. On receiving command of the armies, Kutuzov remembered Prince Andrew and sent an order for him to report at headquarters. Prince Andrew arrived at Severozaymish on the very day and at the very hour that Kutuzov was reviewing the troops for the first time. He stopped in the village at the priest's house, in front of which stood the commander-in-chief's carriage, and he sat down on the bench at the gate awaiting His Serene Highness, as everyone now called Kutuzov. From the field, beyond the village, came now sounds of regimental music and now the roar of many voices shouting hurrah to the new commander-in-chief. Two orderlies, a courier, and a major domo stood nearby, some 10 paces from Prince Andrew, availing themselves of Kutuzov's absence and of the fine weather. A short, swarthy lieutenant colonel of hussars with thick moustaches and whiskers rode up to the gate and, glancing at Prince Andrew, inquired whether His Serene Highness was putting up there and whether he would soon be back. Prince Andrew replied that he was not on His Serene Highness's staff, but was himself a new arrival. The lieutenant colonel turned to a smart orderly, who, with the peculiar contempt with which a commander-in-chief's orderly speaks to officers, replied, "What, His Serene Highness? I expect he'll be here soon. What do you want?" The lieutenant colonel of hussars smiled beneath his moustache at the orderly's tone, dismounted, gave his horse to a dispatcher runner, and approached Bolkonski with a slight bow. Bolkonski made room for him on the bench, and the lieutenant colonel sat down beside him. "You are also waiting for the commander-in-chief," he said. "They say he receives everyone, thank God. It's awful with those sausage-eaters. Ermolov had reason to ask to be promoted to be a German. Now, perhaps, Russians will get a look in. As it was, devil only knows what was happening. We kept wet-weeting and were tweeting. Did you take part in the campaign?" he asked. Wow, I know that voice. Midway through reading that, was like, yes, I know who this is. Awesome little twist. "I had the pleasure," replied Prince Andrew, "not only of taking part in the retreat, but of losing in that retreat all I held dear, not to mention the estate and home of my birth, my father, who died of grief. I belong to the province of Smolensk." "Ah, you're Prince Bolkonski? Very glad to make your acquaintance. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Denisov, better known as Vaska," said Denisov, pressing Prince Andrew's hand and looking into his face with a particularly kindly attention. "Yes, I heard," said he sympathetically, and after a short pause added, "Yes, it's Scythian warfare. It's all very well, only not for those who get it in the neck. So you are Prince Andrew Bolkonski?" He swayed his head. "Very pleased, Prince, to make your acquaintance," he repeated, again smiling sadly, and he again pressed Prince Andrew's hand. Prince Andrew knew Denisov from what Natasha had told him of her first suitor. This memory carried him sadly and sweetly back to those painful feelings of which he had not thought lately, but which still found place in his soul. Of late, he had received so many new and very serious impressions, such as the retreat from Smolensk, his visit to Bald Hills, and the recent news of his father's death, and had experienced so many emotions that for a long time, past those memories had not entered his mind, and now that they did not act on him with nearly their former strength. For Denisov, too, the memories awakened by the name of Bolkonski belonged to a distant romantic past, when after supper and after Natasha's singing he had proposed to a little girl of 15 without realizing what he was doing. He smiled at the recollection of that time and of his love for Natasha and passed at once to what now interested him passionately and exclusively. This was a plan of campaign he had devised while serving at the outposts during the retreat. He had proposed that plan to Barclay de Tolly and now wished to propose it to Kutuzov. The plan was based on the fact that the French line of operation was too extended, and it proposed that instead of, or concurrently with, action on the front to bar the advance of the French, we should attack their line of communication. He began explaining his plan to Prince Andrew. They can't hold all that line. It's impossible. I will undertake to break through. Give me 500 men and I will break the line, that's certain. There's only one way, guerrilla warfare. Denisov rose and began gesticulating as he explained his plan to Bolkonski. In the midst of this explanation, shouts were heard from the army, growing more incoherent and more diffused, mingling with music and songs and coming from the field where the review was held. Sounds of hoofs and shouts were nearing the village. "He's coming, he's coming," shouted a Cossack standing at the gate. Bolkonski and Denisov moved to the gate at which a knot of soldiers, a guard of honour, was standing, and they saw Kutuzov coming down the street, mounted on a rather small sorrel horse. A huge suite of generals rode behind him. Barclay was riding almost beside him, and a crowd of officers ran after and around them, shouting hurrah. His adjutants galloped into the yard before him. Kutuzov was impatiently urging on his horse, while which ambled smoothly under his weight, and he raised his hand to his white horse guard's cap with a red band and no peak, nodding his head continually. When he came up to the guard of honour, a fine set of grenadiers, mostly wearing decorations, who were giving him the salute, he looked at them silently and attentively for nearly a minute with the steady gaze of a commander, and then turned to the crowd of generals and officers surrounding him. Suddenly, his face assumed a subtle expression. He shrugged his shoulders with an air of perplexity. "And with such fine fellows to retreat and retreat. Well, goodbye, General," he added, and rode into the yard past Prince Andrew and Denisov. "Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah," shouted those behind him. Since Prince Andrew had last seen him, Kutuzov had grown still more corpulent, flaccid and fat. But the bleached eyeball, the scar, and the familiar weariness of his expression were still the same. He was wearing the white horse guard's cap and a military overcoat, with a whip hanging over his shoulder by a thin strap. He sat heavily and swayed limply on his brisk little horse. "Woo, woo, woo," he whistled just audibly as he rode into the yard. His face expressed the relief of relaxed strain felt by a man who means to rest after a ceremony. He drew his left foot out of the stirrup and, lurching with his whole body and puckering his face with the effort, raised it with difficulty onto the saddle, leaned on his knee, groaned and slipped down into the arms of the Cossacks and adjutants who stood ready to assist him. He pulled himself together, looked round, screwing up his eyes, glanced at Prince Andrew, and evidently not recognizing him, moved with his waddling gait to the porch. "Woo, woo, woo," he whistled. And again, glanced at Prince Andrew. As often occurs with old men, it was only after some seconds that the impression produced by Prince Andrew's face linked itself up with Kutuzov's remembrance of his personality. "Ah, how do you do, my dear prince? How do you do, my dear boy? Come along," said he, glancing warily around, and he stepped onto the porch, which creaked under his weight. He unbuttoned his coat and sat down on a bench in the porch. "And how's your father?" "I received news of his death yesterday," replied Prince Andrew abruptly. Kutuzov looked at him with eyes wide open and with dismay, and then took off his cap and crossed himself. "May the kingdom of heaven be his. God's will be done to us all," he sighed deeply, his whole chest heaving, and was silent for a while. "I loved him and respected him, and sympathize with you with all my heart." He embraced Prince Andrew, pressing him to his fat breast, and for some time did not let him go. When he released him, Prince Andrew saw that Kutuzov's flabby lips were trembling and that tears were in his eyes. He sighed and pressed on the bench with both hands and raised himself. "Come, come with me. We'll have a talk," said he. But at that moment, Denisov, no more intimidated by his superiors than by the enemy, came with jingling spurs up the steps of the porch, despite the angry whispers of the adjutants who tried to stop him. Kutuzov, his hands still pressed on the seat, glanced at him glumly. Denisov, having given his name, announced that he had to communicate to His Serene Highness a matter of great importance for their country's welfare. Kutuzov looked warily at him, and lifting his hands with a gesture of annoyance, folded them across his stomach, repeating the words, "For our country's welfare? Well, that... what is it? Speak." Denisov blushed like a girl. It was strange to see the colour rise in that shaggy, bibulous, time-worn face, and boldly began to expound his plan of cutting the enemy lines of communication between Smolensk and Vyazma. Denisov came from those parts and knew the country well. His plan seemed decidedly a good one, especially from the strength of conviction with which he spoke. Kutuzov looked down at his own legs, occasionally glancing at the door of the adjoining hut as if expecting something unpleasant to emerge from it. And from that hut, while Denisov was speaking, a general with a portfolio under his arm really did appear. "What?" said Kutuzov in the midst of Denisov's explanations. "Are you ready so soon?" "Ready, Your Serene Highness," replied the general. Kutuzov swayed his head as much as to say, "How is one man to deal with it all?" and again listened to Denisov. "I give my word of honour as a Russian officer," said Denisov, "that I can wake Napoleon's line of communication." "What relation are you to Intendant General Kirill Andreevich Denisov?" said Kutuzov, interrupting him. "He is my uncle, Your Serene Highness." "Ah, we are friends. We were friends," said Kutuzov cheerfully. "All right, all right. Friend, stay here at the staff and tomorrow we'll have a talk." With a nod to Denisov, he turned away and put out his hand for the papers Konovstin had brought him. "Would not Your Serene Highness like to come inside?" said the general on duty in a discontented voice. "The plans must be examined and several papers have to be signed." An adjutant came out and announced that everything was in readiness within, but Kutuzov evidently did not wish to enter the room till he was disengaged. He made a grimace. "No, tell them to bring a small table out here, my dear boy. I'll look at them here," said he. "Don't go away," he added, turning to Prince Andrew, who remained in the porch and listened to the general's report. While this was being given, Prince Andrew heard the whispers of a woman's voice and the rustle of a silk dress behind the door. Several times on glancing that way, he noticed behind that door a plump, rosy, handsome woman in a pink dress with a lilac silk kerchief on her head, holding a dish and evidently awaiting the entrance of the commander-in-chief. Kutuzov's adjutant whispered to Prince Andrew that this was the wife of the priest whose home it was, and that she intended to offer His Serene Highness bread and salt. The footnote says it is a Russian custom to present bread and salt to anyone who is taking up residence in a new place. In practice, the bread and salt is often represented by a cake and a silver dish of white powdered sugar. "Her husband has welcomed His Serene Highness with the cross at the church, and she intends to welcome him in the house. She's very pretty," added the adjutant with a smile. At those words, Kutuzov looked around. He was listening to the general's report, which consisted chiefly of a criticism of the position at Severozaymish, as he had listened to Denisov, and 7 years previously had listened to the discussion at the Austerlitz Council of War. He evidently listened only because he had ears which, though there was a piece of tow in one of them, could not help hearing, but it was evident that nothing the general could say would surprise or even interest him, that he knew all that would be said beforehand, and heard it all only because he had to, and as one has to listen to the chanting of a service prayer. All that Denisov had said was clever and to the point. What the general was saying was even more clever and to the point. But it was evident that Kutuzov despised knowledge and cleverness and knew of something else that would decide the matter, something independent of cleverness and knowledge. Prince Andrew watched the commander-in-chief's face attentively, and the only expression he could see there was one of boredom, curiosity as to the meaning of the feminine whispering behind the door, and a desire to observe propriety. It was evident that Kutuzov despised cleverness and learning and even the patriotic feeling shown by Denisov, but despised them not because of his own intellect, feelings, or knowledge. He did not try to display any of these, but because of something else. He despised them because of his old age and experience of life. The only instruction Kutuzov gave of his own accord during that report referred to looting by the Russian troops. At the end of the report, the general put before him the signature, a paper relating to the recovery of payment from army commanders for green oats mown down by the soldiers when landowners lodged petitions for compensation. After hearing the matter, Kutuzov smacked his lips together and shook his head. "Into the stove, into the fire with it. I tell you once for all, my dear fellow," said he, "into the fire with all such things. Let them cut the crops and burn wood to their heart's content. I don't order it or allow it, but I don't exact compensation either. One can't get on without it. When wood is chopped, the chips will fly." He looked at the paper again. "Oh, this German precision," he muttered, shaking his head. All right, there we go, another chapter down. I think De Fleury has summed it up best here with their comment, "Hooray, Denisov lives." Yeah, that's my predominant feeling coming out of that chapter, is just, I really liked Denisov, and I'm so glad that he's still alive. And, hey, he's doing pretty well, too. Gee, I wouldn't want to be proposing any kind of a plan in front of this Kutuzov fellow. He seems like a pretty tough crowd. But it was cool to see that Denisov is planning. He's at the planning and proposition stage of the army, whatever you call that. He's there making proposals to the big dogs. Pretty cool. 100157 says the transliteration, "Les rubiat shepli letyat," was the Russian for "when wood is chopped, wood chips will fly." Apparently the English equivalent is "you can't make an omelette without breaking an egg." That's from WikiQuote, under the section Russian Proverbs. 100157 says, and also related, the saying, "let the chips fall where they may, no matter what the consequences," as in, "I'm going to tell the truth about what happened and let the chips fall where they may." This metaphoric term alludes to chopping wood and is usually joined to a statement that one should do what is right, that is, the woodcutter should pay attention to the main task of cutting logs and not worry about the small chips. That's from the late 1800s. Source for that, the American Heritage Dictionary of Idioms. That sounds like a pretty cool book. I'd love to get a dictionary of idioms. Carcass Tree had a question, saying, vis-a-vis the last line, what did Germany have to do with anything? Royal Inigan said, "I think it has to do with how Russians generally disliked the Germans and called all foreigners German. I think I remember previously reading some of the Russian officers denigrating German officers for their meticulous and scientific methods." This seems to be what Kutuzov is referring to concerning all these scrupulous reports and theories that he has had just been subjected to. All right, so there we go. Another chapter down. I did something kind of fun today. So I don't know if you guys know about Launchpad. It's a small business that I created and that I run. It's my day job. And I create these books, anthology books of short stories where kids from local primary schools write the short stories with my help. So basically my day job is making up stories with kids, which then be turned into published books. About a year ago, I came up with a second workshop offering that I could offer to the local schools. It was called Sticky Note Stories. And the idea was, it's like a mini version of Launchpad, where you're given not, you know, a month or 6 weeks to work on a short story. You're given just 2 hours. And instead of writing a draft, writing a plan, writing a good draft, typing it up, we don't get to do any of that. You handwrite your story on 6 post-it notes. Sticky notes, I should say, for copyright reasons. 6 sticky notes, and you're allowed to be as creative as you want with those 6 sticky notes. You can draw, you can write, you can scribble, you can do whatever. And you make a little story. Today, finally, actually about a month ago, a school called me up out of the blue and said they were interested in the sticky notes story workshop. I was about to remove it from my website because it had taken months and months and months of me trying to sell it to schools. At the start of the year, I do a lot of sales and that kind of thing. And I would offer it to every single school and no one seemed interested. So I kind of just gave up on it. But it was still available on my website. And somebody found it and a little while ago called up and said they wanted to do it. And then today we went out and did it. So I hung out with 48 kids in grades 3 and 4. So we're talking kids who are about 8 years old. Writing little funny little comic strip style stories on sticky notes, which will become a real published book that they can get copies of. Such a weird thing, but that's what I did today. And every time I go to a school and teach kids and do these workshops, something unexpected happens. And I suppose the thing that happened unexpected today was that I taught two different kids on two separate occasions how to draw a toilet. The first time I was like, hey, I didn't expect that I'd be teaching a kid how to draw a toilet today. And then, a good hour later, I'm teaching another kid and I'm like, wow, okay. This is the second time I've ever taught someone how to draw a toilet and it is occurring on the same day as the first. What a weird day this is. Anyway, that was my day today so far. And of course, speaking to you lovely people, we did get, actually, before I go, one more Patreon supporter overnight. I want to give a quick shout out to that person and I am stalling while I look up their name. Ewan. Thank you, Ewan, for becoming a patron of the podcast. Your support means a lot to me and thank you to the other Patreons as well. I am going to make some Patreon only material to release through Patreon. So if you want to sign up, we're going to get a few bonus things, maybe a little letter, and even a podcast exclusively for you guys. I don't know, something. I got to do something cool for you guys. But regardless, I don't think anyone really signed up to get rewards. I think it's just a show of appreciation for the podcast. So I do really thank you for supporting me in making this project. An episode every single day is a heck of a lot of work. So I do appreciate that people are chipping in to make it make it worth my while. To be honest, I really enjoy doing it, so it is worth my while. But you know what I mean. It is, the money goes a long way to cover the fees and to cover my time and everything like that. So, thank you. I'm babbling now. Okay, thanks very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow.